Ding dong.
Welcome to this episode of the Justice Team podcast on the Justice Team Network. And today we have the pleasure of having our favorite Irish barrister on, Ronan Dugan.
Thank you so much, Bob. I tell you what, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm not quite bourbon approved territory yet.
You know what? If you get your drinking skills on, I know we meet a lot of 317s across the calendar year. If you keep it up, you might be able to get on.
I must say, on behalf of my countrymen, we don't know anything about this drink you talk of.
Not, by the way, aware. It's St. Paddy's Day, not St. Paddy's Day.
Yeah, St. Patrick's or Paddy's. St. Patty is your auntie from Wisconsin or Columbus, Ohio. We don't know her.
P-A-D-D-Y. It's, yeah, so Ronan, he does not like that. So we are very, our esteemed guest today has been part of trials where they're getting 8-9 figure verdicts on cases that are single event, auto crashes, motorcycle crashes, and the decedent or the person that was driving the motorcycle is on meth.
Yes.
There are terrible facts, and those facts are coming in from the jury, and you guys are still achieving these results.
Yes, it's important I point out at this stage that my wingman in those operations is Arash Amanpour, who's maybe one of the most accomplished trial attorneys has ever done it. So I am a very, very sexy bridesmaid at best, Bob. But no, I mean, it's been a wondrous section of my career working with this guy. And yes, we seem to have a niche now in cases involving people who have been on drugs and have various qualities of life, etc. And it's kind of perfect insofar as Mr. Amanpour loves to go to trial. And those are the kind of trials that defense people feel, oh, they're just worthless. You know, this person had a drug problem. This person was homeless. This person had X, Y, and Z. And it gives you an opportunity to really go and do some avant-garde trial practice. And I get to sit there in the back like a dancer in the Backstreet Boys.
Yeah, all
that. No, but no, it's been great. I want to just say before we carry on, this man here is the reason why I became a plaintiff's lawyer. I was one of those miserable shithead defense attorneys. No disrespect to them. They're often lovely people. And it was Bob Simon who got me into this style of law. Yeah, so like I have to thank you live to the
You know what's fun? You know what? You know, I actually remember the first time we met in person, but Ronan first met because he was sliding into my DMs with a burner account trolling me. And it actually did work. And then we started talking about Dungeons and Dragons and other things. We ran a campaign actually almost 3 years ago to this. No, yeah. 4 years because it was 2020. It was right before COVID. We did our first campaign, Dungeons and Dragons, well, Ravel. We had our little notebooks that had our face on it. We rolled our characters. We did some dungeon crawling for the better part of the next year and a half.
Yeah, it was crazy. And what I remember was I thought it was a wind-up. I thought he might have been winding me up initially. And he's like, oh, we're putting together this game. And I said, this better not be a wind-up. But I'm going into a situation. And it wasn't. And it became like more and more like, what's actually happening here? This is weird. And I showed up at a house that I didn't know was Brad's house.
Oh, my brother.
And I'm sat out there and I'm like, there's no one here. I'm gonna get jumped by a bunch of burly Manhattan beachers. And then Greg Shaver pulled up behind me and said, okay, he could be a hitman, he may not be. And I said, okay, it started to calm down then. And we went in and we played the game. And it was some of the happiest, I'm a gaming connoisseur.
Yeah,
you know that.
We were talking before the episode about, you know, Ronan's getting into some Warhammer gaming with some various Steam. Well, the guy played Superman.
Yeah, maybe we'll see. But I tell you, no, I've been into all that since I was a kid. So it was great to find attorneys here that didn't go, I say it to some people and go, what the hell's wrong with you? And I say, well, I don't golf and I don't that and I play with little toy soldiers because my life is dope and I do dope shit.
It was building a tribe, during COVID, we had our group that still got together virtually to be able to do these things. And it was like, you know, it was awesome. So, I don't think any of us were on meth though. A lot of your clients were during those sessions. I mean, maybe somebody was. We had some very, you know, very articulate mages that got off into very weird shit.
Yeah, it was great. What I really loved was, and I tended to do this, and they should remain nameless for this, but we would take well-known attorneys in our community, and they would become cameo characters.
Yes.
The Drowleys.
Yeah, that was good. The Grey Wolf.
Sorry, Nick. You were an arch nemesis in there, but that's only because you're so good. It was, and we did a bit of that, didn't we?
It was good. It was fun, and that was the best campaign we ever did.
Best campaign. And do you remember some of the final battles? Sometimes when you play these games, they just, a dice can destroy the epicness of it. But we got lucky, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
They turn into these incredible.
I remember when you rolled a natural, we could do 100s instead of 20s for something crazy that happened on that one of those hotels, or we were on a boat. I don't remember. Anyway, so
we're lawyers, Bob. We're lawyers. Let's get back to it.
Let's get back to practical advice for lawyers. So, their firm has got the biggest results. I mean, in trial, probably in the past 3 years. And these are cases that most lawyers would say no to. In fact, most lawyers did say no to these cases. They were turned down.
Yep.
They were like, this person's 100% at fault, et cetera. So walk us through kind of the first one. What were the big issues and how did you deal with them?
Okay. So the first one we had, and I'll tell the ending before I start the story.
I like this.
As my grandfather used to say. It actually, we won. It was a very, very hard fought thing. A really, a clean as a victory as you can get. And we had an unfortunate judge who decided to order a retrial, and that's now, we're in appeal world on that. So that somewhat took the sting
out. Yeah, and that judge is one of the worst judges, and now he's off the bench.
I'm telling you what, mm-hmm. it was unbelievable. Now, I've practiced in two countries, and I've never seen anything like it. This particular mm-hmm. judge really, really just has an inbuilt bias against what
plaintiff's
attorneys
do. He'll do everything you can
to
try to make you lose.
So we were up against it from day one, and we knew that he was going to try and do that. So we were running a very clean trial. So anyway, Andrade was a case where a young gentleman, I think he was in his 20s. I may screw up some of the basic facts. But he was on a motorcycle heading to work one morning, and a truck going on a delivery pulled out in front of him, and he basically braked and banged into the truck and died, right? And there was a lot of complex, leaving aside the issues of he as a person and all that and the stuff about damages, it was a complex scientific case because we had two accident reconstruction experts who were diametrically opposed, very far apart. And what we had to do was we had to engage in very expensive FEM analysis. So what happens is...
What's FEM?
Yeah, finite element material analysis is what it is. If there's any engineers listening, I got it wrong. I don't care, I'm not an engineer. So what happens is normally when crashes happen, they analyze certain markers on the road that can detect speed, and they analyze the weights involved and the crushes that happen. And they input those into various formulae, and it pumps out what the speed of the traveling vehicle was, say, that hit, in this case, the motorcycle. And between the two accident recon, there was something like a 30 or 20 mile an hour difference. And I was like, and I said myself in a rational, like, how is it so far apart? Obviously,
usually when you have the accident reconstructionist for both sides, they're not too much different because it's science.
It's exactly.
Yeah.
So what we ended up doing was he basically, our expert, Steve Anderson, who's absolutely brilliant.
Oh, yeah. He's a motorcycle guy.
If you have a motorcycle case, he is the man. He and I must have spent hours he's so generous with his time explaining the science, and he gives you a real education. Anyway, he's a brilliant
expert. He's with MEA Forensic?
Yes.
MEA Forensic in
I'm telling you,
Laguna.
If you're out there, you have a motorcycle case, do the investment. Don't try to save on it. Get him. He's amazing. Anyway, so what happened was I said to him, how do you definitively demonstrate this shit? What's the gold standard? He says, well, the gold standard is we buy a fleet of vehicles and smash them together. Right? And that would cost millions. But the next thing down is finite element analysis. So when car companies or vehicle companies are making new vehicles, they don't build hundreds of prototypes. They have these extremely detailed computer models where every element that goes into the car, whether it be the metal, the plastic, the rubber, whatever, the characteristics of it are perfectly mapped digitally, right?
Are these the manufacturers?
The manufacturers.
Okay.
Now, in this particular case, we got very lucky because the truck involved in the case had a model that was very, very close in the public domain. So we could get that model and run our own crash analysis with this. And sure enough, all that does is you put in the elements, you get the truck, you build an approximation of the motorcycle, and you crash it. And then you can map that and show that specifically what happens versus what happened by going, if we run it at 30 miles an hour, it'll be this deep. If we run it at 60 miles an hour, this deep.
So if you're going as fast as the other side says, you're going to be, the body's going to fly way further.
Exactly. Now so what happened was, back up for a second, Steve said to me, he said, look, Ronan, I've seen these crashes day in, day out for years. And I'm telling you, that car was not doing, say, 60 or 70 or 80 when it hit. It was a much lower speed because the whole truck would be basically crushed completely in. So with the model analysis, we showed it. And it was so devastating to them. It really, who knows how they're going to pivot if this goes to another trial. But the science was clear.
I mean, it seems like, we try these cases and they're disputing liability. If you spend enough time in analysis, I know you guys are hyper focused on detail. you could really put so many holes that'll piss off the jury.
Well, what happened was a rash crossed him in trial, naturally enough. And it was just a machine gunning. Like he got a proper walloping. And we were, it came to a point where the jury just, we just felt that they understood the science about halfway through that, maybe even before. The other aspects of it. So, okay, when you have one of these cases, there's all these things that at first blush look like they're terrible. We had two eyewitnesses saying he was speeding. We had the toxicology. We had this, we had that. We had this expert saying this. And each one of those things, I think, can often send us away as mm-hmm. people who may get involved in a case. And in fairness to Arash, because he's done so much of it and he has a scientific mind, he starts to break those things down. So the witnesses, we can completely demolish them. And I tell you what, I've seen a lot of fancy, intricate cross-examination in my career. Arash has all of those skills. I'm not big up, and I'm like, I already have the job, by the way. Like, I'm not doing an interview here. But he gets up and he gets a feeling, and some trial lawyers have this, and maybe people can learn it, but he just gets good feelings about people just are going to collapse. Mm-hmm. And he literally said, he asked two questions of this witness who was their key witness in terms of he was speeding. And he basically said, that's not true, right? And she completely collapsed. Now, if you see that on paper, like, what did this dude do? He just asked, that's not true. Whatever it was a very simple question, but he had a feeling and he sat right on her emotionally and she just caved in. And then as they tried to pull her back, and it just didn't work. So he has that instinct to collapse people, and that can happen certainly with experts. And that's something that a lot of us, mm-hmm. we go in with fancy schematics to deconstruct a brain. But you get a feeling and you chase it.
You got to go with it. You know how many times, I've been in trial, and one of my good friends, Grayson Cooties, here, outside the recording studio, at the deposition. And I remember I had this one witness on the stand, and like, I had that feeling, and I took a chance. And it fucking worked. And Grace knew afterward, I could see he stark white. And he goes off and he was like, dude, that was fucking risky. He's like, that was a huge risk. And,
yeah.
But you feel like, you know, whenever you have somebody, you know what I'm saying? Like, if
100%.
You get that gut feeling. And I mean, I've never now had it not work, but it's.
Yeah, I think.
It's like the upper level.
Yeah, he's right. I think what happens is I learn by writing. So I often write outlines. But if I carry them to the lectern to do a witness or two or three, if I'm allowed, I abandon it. You must. Yeah. Because what happens is you create an algorithm that starts to affect you in your questioning. And if you don't abandon your programming when they go off and do mm-hmm. something you're not expecting, you'll start to collapse a bit and the jury will sense it. So keep it open. Keep it open. Bornstein, the judge, was a very difficult judge to question with, because he was constantly egging on the defense to object.
He's making his own objections. Trying to get him to object. It's crazy.
And you know, when you start, sometimes the judge will put you in a foundation hole, I call it. And he kept doing that in a series of questions to me. And I felt like, okay, let's start from the beginning of time. Are you on planet Earth?
Let's lay that foundation.
Are you a human being?
And for those that are listening, when this says lay foundation, usually the judge's cue card to you is like, take a step back, and then it's reframed to make sure we understand the sandbox that you're playing in. But a lot of times judges that are control freaks or rooting against you keep just using that to try to,
yeah, right.
to throw you off. And it's a lot of lawyers, if they stick to that script, they can't understand. When that happens, it throws them off completely. I do it to defense lawyers too. Yeah. Objection and foundation. And if it gets sustained, they're so off their game, they don't know how to backpedal it out.
You collapse psychologically so what I do is I lean into the, Arash wouldn't agree with this. That's not his style, but we all have our own styles. I would kind of self-deprecate to some degree. And I kind of turn to the jury and kind of do a bit of this. But honestly, he was putting me in such a foundation hole on some of these. And this was a basic witness. This was one of the family members. And I kind of then just backed out and gone, and I backed right out. So it put the onus back on the judge to stop being a prick.
Jury feels it too.
Yeah, they feel it.
Yeah, the jury's like, come on, judge. Like, we know, like, they're going to answer the question eventually. So why do we do this,
right.
for morale?
So I kind of, you turn it into an entertaining experience for the jury. They get a little education on what's going on. But a lot of young lawyers who go to trial get stuck in that moment and they start to panic, and then they go to a new, they shift away from an important section and they go to a new set of questions. Don't, calm down, let the jury know you're trying to deal with a problem, and then back out to the beginning of time. but anyway, even on the basic math, we destroyed them. But then we took it to the next level with this analysis. Again, not every firm out there, sorry, not every defense situation, or sorry, not every case you have, you'll actually have access to that wireframe model, the FEM model, in the public domain. I suppose you could theoretically go build one, but that probably costs $1 million or something. But we got lucky in that, and those are the things where we got lucky, because we start asking the bloody right questions mm-hmm. about where we go to definitively prove this. If an expert is saying, look, I'm telling you, Ronan, I've done this for 30 odd years, I know this is not the speed, there's got to be something to get you there. So when you deal with your experts, again, I think what happens often, Bob, is people are reluctant to have, I do a Columbo routine. I don't know.
Columbo. Peter Falk. Yeah, I know Columbo.
But I don't know the answers to these things. I'm not a fancy pants. There's some fancy pants out there not willing to admit. I go to the experts and go, I'm a child. You educate me about this subject.
But that's what you should do. You should lean on your experts to educate you, because you have to do the same thing to a jury later, like a child. Yeah. People don't lean into their experts or ask them the right questions, because they have a wealth of information and things that they can open up to you. But a lot of lawyers get lazy. They just take what the case is given to them, et cetera.
Well, I tell you, even when I started with you lot, I didn't know anything about the kind of cases you did, the spinal stuff and all that. And I start going, okay, I start asking basic questions. I remember an early day I was in the Hermosa office and Sebi was there. And I asked him a basic propositional question about how you deal with past meds or whatever the hell it was. And he gave me an answer and I was like, I don't understand that at all. Mm. And Sebi may not recall this, but I do. And I said, well, how do you do that? Like, what? I think we all go around with a lot of bravado. I'm this, I'm that. Abandon all that shit. Learn everything you can by asking questions. Don't be afraid to be foolish. If you want to give yourself a little psychological out, sometimes I use the phrase now, this may sound kind of stupid, and then you ask the question, but do it. And again, what happens in the upper sphere of any particular field is all the experts are so used to the shorthand that sometimes they're not even open to a new way of thinking about it, which the jury will need, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So again, young lawyers out there in particular, if you're going to experts, break it right down. And you might come up with interesting ideas that even your bosses and the fancy trial lawyers will like. And that will help with the jury.
Yeah, and when you're working with your experts, do everything on the phone, because anything in writing or email is discoverable.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So let's talk about one of the big issues here is the drug use, methamphetamine, the meth that was in the system of your motorcycle. It was meth, right?
It was methamphetamine. It was marijuana and a partridge in a pear tree. But it was, yes. Here's the thing about drugs and finding them in people who are deceased. Just because drugs happen to exist inside of a person doesn't necessarily mean they contributed to the accident.
Exactly. Right? So there's negligence and substantial factor.
Right. Now, we really, I mean, I'm telling you what, one of the finest depositions I've ever seen was Arash taking session one of their toxicologist.
Who did they use?
Bob, you always show how bad I am at names.
Vina Schweiler?
No, I've deposed her. Gave her a hiding. She ran.
Yeah.
I'm not blowing my own horn, but I took a depo of her for our second case, Rubalcaba, and I gave her a bloody hiding.
She eventually will tell you that she can't predict. Yeah, I mean, with these toxicologists, like practice point, when you guys are taking the deposition of the defense expert, they will tell you that, look, I can only tell you how many drinks they had in their system or what was in their system, but I can't tell you if they were impaired.
Yes, right.
And that's the critical question. That's a substantial factor. To a reasonable degree of toxicologist probability, was there impairment?
Yeah.
Did you say this caused or contributed to this whatsoever specifically for this person?
Yeah. So there's a thing cutting to the chase, there's a thing they use, which is, I think it's Barry Logan was a guy, he was a toxicologist, who wrote this kind of seminal paper on this. Mm-hmm. And it's layers and layers.
Is it Barry London?
Barry Logan. I think it's Logan. If I'm wrong, some smarty aleck out there will correct us, but it's Barry Logan. And he has a graph that is often used by these defense toxicologists. And it works like this on methamphetamine in particular. You see a graph dip down and you see different effects written on the graph as you have a higher concentration of meth or amphetamine in the system. And you'll have written things beside agitation, loss of motor control, paranoia. But there's no relationship to those statements to causality in terms
Correct.
Of the percentage chance of that happening. So a lot of people who take these depots, they go down the primrose path with these bloody toxicologists and let the toxicologists get away with saying all this shit. So what we do, and Hamanpour really laid this into me and all of his excellent team over there, we go after every bit of underlying article or literature. Mm-hmm. And they all basically are either incomplete control groups, mm-hmm. they don't create a probability relationship, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
You just have to figure out the sample size, keep get all
going,
the data.
Keep going.
Exactly.
And all Spieler and the likes of them, they all know this, but they try to get away with it. And they'll really scrap you until they quit. And then when they quit, you start to get the concessions and the quotes that become your motions and limits.
Correct.
Now,
correct.
We really did enough on the first one, Andrade, to, I think, to have all excluded. There was even chain of custody issues.
Well, but I mean, you're, yeah. And here's the realistic, though. You do everything right. You do everything perfect. There's no way it should come to evidence.
And it comes in.
And then it comes in. Because you have judges like you had in your trial that want you to lose. And you have to be able to deal with that. Yeah. And when you're trying your cases and doing focus groups ahead of that, you have to let these bad evidence come in. Because you can't assume that, well, it's out.
Yeah.
Well, talk to us about the one thing that a lot of lawyers miss is the foundation stuff.
Yes.
The toxicologist, the stuff at the hospital. Walk us through how you dealt with that.
So,
because you do, I've had trials where we kept it out.
Yeah.
You got to be prepared to keep it in, but there's ways to keep it out if you do it right.
Yeah. So I'm trying to remember we attacked every front of this, but aspect one is the chain of custody of the sample. And what happened was our expert looked at it and said, look, on paper it looks right, but you can put them up to it. You can force them to start calling people and doing that. Typically, certainly in places like LA, those offices and the coroner's offices are getting better and better at dealing with that. But that's phase one. Is the like old school, like where did this sample go? Could it be contaminated? What bottle was it put in? How was it handled, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
How was it calibrated along? If you see that hospital record, sometimes it'll put at the bottom, it'll say not to be used for legal proceedings.
Right.
They didn't run a control. They didn't run it again. They didn't run it a second time.
Right.
And that's a lot of times foundationally you can get it out.
Now, that wasn't our issue with this one. What happened, what ended up happening to kind of cut through some of the, look, I'm, by the
way. But it came in his trial, it came in.
It bloody well came in. Yeah. And one of the issues we had was it came to a finite point where there was law that says if someone basically just records an automated result, that is not necessarily hearsay in a certain situation. But we had found out through the course of examination that one of the people in the office actually had to do a simple piece of math to convert the result into the end printed result. And we thought we had the law rock solid on this. Again, Borenstein was really up against, we were up against on every level. And he ultimately said, no, that math is so simple that we made the argument, like, what's the difference if it's 10,000 calculations versus one? It's the human element that changes
it. Yeah, the one calculation.
And that was another thing that Borenstein kind of fucked us over on. But anyway, the bottom line is it came in. But I will say this for anyone listening, if you have a case where people, you have a decedent or even people still living, if they have these issues, if these issues are in your case, we have all the motions in limine, we have all the depot transfers, Bob, I'm sure, as well. So don't go into that not knowing how we've classically destroyed these people. Come at us and we give you the info we share because we're a good community of commies over here in the plaintiff's bar. Anyway, so it came in. And then what you do is once the judge goes, right, Matt's coming in, you're obviously going to cover it in your mini opening and you're going to devour it in your voir dire and you're going to spend time on it. And you're going to ask people about the prejudices that emerge by just the thought of someone having used certain drugs.
Not having a good judge, but were you able to get jurors off just for cause, which means the judge is just striking them because they can't be fair no matter what?
I tell you what, that's a funny one. So Arash did the jury selection and he did the voir dire. He's brilliant. And he's very, very, he really hunts for the fine answer. And he said, right, Ron, you go do the cause challenges.
Oh my God.
So we went back into Borenstein's and Arash had not seen me do submissions up to that point and it went quite well. And he came and he said, yeah, you're all right. You can speak. You're not doing it again, but no. Anyway, so even on that level where we had people slam dunk on cause, he was not kicking.
That's crazy.
Like it was crazy town. But anyway, so you cover all of that. You talk about prejudice. I think Arash, what he had said to a lot of the jurors was like, you know, kind of, I don't know if he said it as inartfully as I'm about to, but he said something like everyone's on something, like, you know, it was one of those things. But we luckily got a panel that could divorce that psychologically.
So, you know, TLDR here, verdict amount for wrongful death for the deceased. What was the amount?
It was $36 million.
36
with a nice bit of 99A flying on the end of that too.
So $36 million, they probably owed $50 million. at the end. Okay. $50 million judgment at the end. How much negligence or comparative did they put on the decedent on meth that they say was speeding? How many? How much?
Zero.
Zero. So he had a person on meth. Jury said 0% at fault.
Yes.
And they gave $36 million.
Yeah, and I'll tell you
how. Even with all these challenges. Even with all these challenges. Yeah, look at that. I got a little goosebumps.
No, I tell you what. If you like that, you ain't seen nothing yet, Bob. No, I tell you, what happened with that was when the meth comes in, what you then do is destruction. You do a destruction of their experts on the issue of impairment. None of them are going to say there was any evidence of impairment, where in this case, a man was driving reasonably straight on a road and we were proving that he wasn't speeding.
And you proved that even if he had nothing in his system, nobody could have avoided this crash.
Exactly. And there's, do you know what, it's very interesting because I spent a ton of time reading about all this. And there's even studies, now this didn't come in and we played around with it, but there's studies that certain like fighter pilots had been given doses of methamphetamine to test their reactions. Because you may or may not know that, like, right? And they perform better.
They perform better. I've seen those studies.
Do you know what's crazy? I only found this out not long ago. I was watching this wonderful documentary on Netflix. Do you know, like when the bloody Nazis were doing
methamphetamines. Yeah, I read it. I mean, I used to read a lot of books and like World War II books, and they were all.
Public safety announcement. Myself and Mr. Simon are not advocating for the use of methamphetamine in the use of complex equipment. But in any event, it's kind of a bunch of nonsense, right? So unless there was actual evidence of impairment, funny driving, weird behavior.
Impairment
is the key.
You put it in every single one of your depositions from foundation, from experts to your expert to their experts. Can you say impairment to a reasonable degree of medical probability? No.
They'll all say no.
Exactly. And that's the thing where like you have, I mean, anybody out there that's listening, I mean, if anyone drinks alcohol, you know people that can finish a whole bottle of bourbon. You know, some people that can't have one drink and act the same.
It's all about tolerance. If you don't have evidence, that's a key issue, actually. If you don't have evidence of tolerance, you do not get to say how it affects them. You might have seen, I posted a video, I was taking some depo with some, he was a neurologist.
And was it Barry Ludwig? Not Barry London, was it Barry Ludwig?
This is a different geezer I put on Instagram, but he basically said that he said a certain level of alcohol, and he said anyone with that level of alcohol. Oh, 0.2 or some shit.
Was that Daryl Clardy? He's a guy that does that.
Exposing my lack of understanding and remembrance of names. But what happened was, I said to him, sir, you have obviously never been to Ireland. You would realize how ridiculous that statement is. But that's crazy. It's a facetious point.
So, like, I had one toxicologist, and he for the defense, and he said, if you have four drinks in an hour, you don't have control of your body. You're tripping over yourself. He had all this analysis, and I was like, and the person that ended up getting catastrophic injured was like the same size as I was. So during that deposition, I had four drinks of bourbon. I sat there, I drank four drinks of bourbon, and I was like, sir, would you be? I mean, according to you, I wouldn't be able to function if I had four drinks in the last hour. He's like, no. I was like, I just drank four bourbons. And like, I'm taking your deposition under penalty of perjury. I'm like, notify my malpractice carrier, maybe.
But it's like bloody Andre the Giant. That dude would have put away 120
pounds.
I know,
it's crazy.
Tolerance being what it is. What was another thing?
So tolerance, impairment, foundation. And at the end of the day, this jury at the end, they heard all this shit.
Yeah.
Right. And they still said, there's nothing. Even if you say what's true, not so. Did the jury say that he was negligent?
Yeah. So here's the key feature, and this tells you how you have to sometimes watch carefully how you do your verdict form. One of the questions was he negligent? And remember, they're reading it sequentially, and we're like sitting there. Oh, here we go. And the answer was yes. I'm like, oh, here we go. Here comes the percent. And they said no. Mm-hmm. And we're like, oh Jesus! Well, it was such a profound moment because we're like, oh, this is going to be a real result here. From speaking to the jurors afterwards, which everyone should do, and I'll talk to you about that in a minute, young lawyers who go out with fancy trial lawyers and do this, you go out with a bloody clipboard and you get all their details. Do not let those people leave without getting contact details, because that's another day's work to talk about how you protect.
And that's where you have other people in your office. A lot of time, the lawyer has to stay in the courtroom with the judge while they release the jury. You have somebody out in the hallway. Where
you get a crew down there. Yep. Don't you're sitting there going, I'm the champion of the world, and then the appeals come and all that. Anyway. So what happened was they had said, we think he was negligent because he had meth in his system, but he wasn't negligent in the operation of the vehicle. So that's what was zero. Yep. And that was a big thing. And I don't want to, there's stuff going on with the appeal that I won't comment on, but that was, they totally got it. In fact, one juror said something. He's like, yeah, I think there was some testimony that he'd been at, this guy had been at a party a few days before. And sometimes, okay, on the documents from the toxicology report, there was a little mention of ecstasy on it, on the report. And the slippery fuckers managed to get that in. And
oh, God.
Anyway, it was a moment where it was flashed on screen and taken off. But one of the very clever jurors had spotted it. And he goes, I bet he was out and he probably took E or something. And a lot of them are co-mixed with very, like, it was really interesting to see how a juror was tackling the potential ins and outs of what that means.
So the juror's probably, at that point, probably rooting for you and figuring out, like, come on, he could have inadvertently had meth in his system due to some sort of accident or some party he went to. And meth's one of those ones that, you can have false positives and it can be days before, right?
It metabolizes. You can tell, you can kind of time it because it metabolizes to amphetamine and that takes a period of time. If you have a case and the tox report says pure methamphetamine, that means they took it recently. But in this case, there was some evidence of amphetamine metabolization as it breaks down. Mm. Right? Another thing, very quickly, Bob, and I know we're running on time here. One of the issues was in the final stages of discovery, I really needed to get to terms with, did anyone talk to him before he got on the bike to actually tell us how impaired or not he was? And from a little bit of a last minute scramble, sure enough, we found a roommate that had spoken to him that morning. In those moments, you don't panic. You immediately correct whatever list you need to correct. You immediately offer them for deposition.
Yeah. You don't want them to be
taken
up.
And you just make it an idiot. What you can have, you just make them look like complete pricks if they say no to it.
Mm-hmm. I'll offer this person for deposition at our cost anytime you want. Yeah. Weekends don't matter. Blah,
exactly.
Blah.
Yep. So that was another thing in this case. We had evidence from a person who saw him just before he got on the bike. And she said he was completely fine. He was totally normal. Now, he may well have been in there taking meth, but again, tolerance or whatever it was, it wasn't affecting him that way. There was other analysis that was going on. We thought he was a guy who was on a fitness journey. Jeez, I hate using the word journey, Bob. Jesus. He was on a fitness journey, and they thought maybe some of the supplements, they used to sell this shit called Jack 3D, which was a pre-workout powder. I fucked around for a while.
You'd be jacked up on
that. There's fucking meth in that. So really? We analyzed that kind of stuff as well. But all in all, it ended up coming in. We had done our work to get an intelligent, compassionate jury. Where it got so bad, I'll tell you this last anecdote on this, or unless you want to carry on, I could talk for days.
I know. That's why I said we should just do a show about talking about these.
Yeah. But in their closing, Arash did this blistering closing, one of the best I've seen. And then they get up and she said something like, the trial attorney, she's a nice lady, but this was obviously a nervous mistake. So it can happen, but you obviously have to exploit this like a fucker. She got up and said, life goes on. That was the first line. Life goes on.
Not for your client.
And we're all sitting there. Oh, boy. And Arash gets up. And he didn't overcut it. He said, it doesn't go on. Like, you know, so you just stay open, stay loose. I'll tell you a true story. When I was a young barrister, I heard a story about an old prime minister of ours called Bertie Ahern. Only in Ireland could you have a chief executive called Bertie Ahern. And he used to be a nervous speaker.
You know, it's funny. I'm already visualizing when we transcribe this episode how much trouble they're going to have. Like at the end. With
English,
you.
Do you not speak it, Americans?
It's going to be like a deposition when the court reporter asks you for some spellings at the end.
In trial, they're telling me to slow down. I'm going really slow. But that extra little click of an accent makes it sound like I'm going fast. I am going fast now because I've had a lot of coffee and meth. Yeah. But what happened was...
The pre-workout meth.
What happened was... Bertie Ahern, this old prime minister, was a very nervous speaker, a bit of a stutterer. And he said, and I've used this, and I invite anyone out there to use it, as silly as it may seem. He goes, when you're nervous before you speak, you picture butterflies, because we have butterflies in our belly, that light feeling when you're not speaking from your power, you're speaking up somewhere here. He goes, picture the butterflies and then force them to fly in formation. And it's a little weird psychological thing I do. When you get up to the lectern, you look and you're like, Common Power's over here, jurors over here, CVN's fucking filming down here. Butterflies, butterflies. Push him into formation, Roman. And
really? You
into formation.
So that trial in LA was not televised, but another one in San Bernardino was on CVN. Is
no,
that correct?
No, it wasn't. Andrade was televised for openings and closings.
Gotcha.
So if you want to see the openings and closings, and I highly recommend it, particularly the rebuttal, was just state of the art. Like, that's awesome. Avant-garde.
So, we're pretty much out of time here, but I just want to TLDR some of these, the really bad facts that led to 8 and 9 figure verdicts. We talk about in LA, on meth, they say speeding, 0% at fault for the motorcycle rider, $36 million, owed 50. You have another one in San Bernardino?
Yeah, correct? No, that was one where it was a really, really fascinating case.
Well, just do the TLDR. What was the verdict?
The verdict on the second one was $34 million and change.
$34 million. And what was the, on meth?
On meth. He might have been on other stuff. No, he was definitely, it was meth there, yeah.
Who was your, was that McCarville? Was that your judge at that
moment? McCarville.
He's right. The best. So
he retired.
He retired. So by the time we air this, McCarville will have retired. He's nicknamed the sheriff in San Bernardino. Oh. And San Bernardino has probably the best bench of judges, but now the older guard who are just fantastic on evidence, very fair what they do. McCarville is one of the best, are in retirement ages. Oh, and I hope to see him retire. He was the best.
I walked in, I didn't tell you this, but I go to trial with a bag of relics, like a monk in the 12th century.
What is your problem?
I have bits of the real cross. I have the Padre Pio piece of cloth. I have my wig. I come in with the whole nine yards.
You say wig or weed?
Wig.
Guy, I know.
Wig. That's wig, Bob. It's a barrister wig. Anyway, so McCarroll, I set up my bag of tricks, my relics on the table, which Arash is now really into. You might deny it. But McCarville's like looking down and going, what's all that, counsel? And I was like, this is from Ireland, that's from Tipperary, this is from Wexford, and this is my barrister.
Now you guys are best friends.
And he's like, well, I'm McCarville, and here's my shillelagh. Like we had a relic off.
Oh my God.
We had a tchotchke off. He's pulling out the shillelaghs and all this kind of carry on. And in that trial, Arash let me take two of the plaintiffs in examination in chief. And I was getting away with bloody murder. Yeah. Like I was leading as leading can be. But McCarr was like, the old country shines.
And that's
through.
Where like
he's McCarr, a great, but he's a great judge.
Yeah, I had my trial I had in front of him on CBN televised as well. And that foundation thing we talked about, the defense lawyer who'd like to object about every single thing. And there was obvious it was going to come in. He kept objecting to foundation. The judge is like, look at him. He's like, you want to make that objection again, counsel? He's like, I will sustain it, but I'm just letting you know. Are you going to do it again? He does it. And the jury's just like, come on, guy.
Yeah.
Like, come on, guy. So Ronan Dugan, how do people find you, first of all?
You go out into the street and you yell, is there an AI out there? Is there actual Irish in LA? And I'll show up like Batman. No, you'll find me I'm at the Hammondpore Law Firm. You can contact me there via my email, which is on the website. I have an Instagram, but it's private because that's where I unleash my most scoundrelly bullshit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And other than that, just get me via email and I'll contact you whatever way you want to be contacted. Yeah,
and if you want to talk, Ron and I talk deep dive about gaming, RPGs, the real fun stuff in life.
Yeah.
So if you want to talk, he played a very, very articulate and fun barbarian in our campaign, and I was a mechanic from the future masquerading and helping the robots, the Autotomans, in that campaign. And it was best year and a half of my life.
I tell you what, it was. And that barbarian would have got me canceled pretty quick. What do you reckon?
Yes, he would have. And that's when the...
But it's called play acting. It's called living the Daniel Day-Lewis improv kind of method shite. Yeah.
And it's that type of stuff that makes that... Some people go to the Child Lawyers College in Wyoming. Some people play D&D type campaigns with their friends to learn how to role play.
Because our lives are dope and we do dope shit.
Ronan, thank you for coming on. Visit justiceteamnetwork.com to find this episode. If you have any questions about meth, gaming, 8 and 9-figure verdicts, reach out to this human being, to the Justice Team Network.
And here's Brandon with the weather.
Shite, shite, shite.